TUC Radio San Francisco, Time of Useful Consciousness. Behind the scenes of the Millennium Meeting. Who navigates Spaceship Earth? While the Millennium Meeting was getting underway at the United Nations, a counter teach-in was held by the International Forum on Globalization. It brought together representatives from environmental organizations from around the world to discuss how the current move towards globalization plays itself out within the UN. Jocelyn Dow is a founding member of Red Thread, a women's collective in Guyana that promotes sustainable business practices. Following the death of Bella Abzug, she was elected the president of the board of directors of WeDo and represents WeDo at major conferences and events. She is very familiar with the inner workings of the United Nations, Jocelyn Dow.
As a Caribbean person, the UN is not distant from your life. And as a black woman, Mr. Kofi Annan is not a victim. He is a disappointment. And for me, I think I'm perhaps particularly glad to speak as both a woman and as a black person here today. Because I think that we must remember that we are, for me certainly, sitting in the heartbeat of triumphal capital, New York. New York is where it's at. Wall Street, after all, is greater than the London Exchange. And frankly, the President of the United States has far more to do with what I eat than with what you eat. Sometimes we say, we wish we could vote since you don't. And I come from a proud tradition in the Caribbean where we worked actively on the new economic order in the 70s, and where I would say the Caribbean governments helped to bring Seattle to its knees. It is our firm stand as Caribbean governments that we will not sign on to these agreements. We will not be treated with disrespect. We're a very small nation, but we perhaps are the oldest example of globalization, 500 years of it. The Caribbean, in case you didn't know, was created to produce the sweet of Europe. They moved people, as never before in history, from everywhere in the world to create a plantation to produce sugar from sugarcane. We are the oldest example of a globalized world. We have people from Africa who came as slaves. We had people from India, Portugal, China, Europe, and interestingly, Madeira, not Portugal, since they came as indentured laborers. We had the plantation owners of Europe. And we understood very well, and we still understand, what it is like to live as the world's oldest transnational reality. We are on our knees. In my country, the United Nations is a very important institution on a daily basis. It is the lead place for us to discuss governance. It is the lead place for women to argue for the right to participate in our governance structures, to a certain place in our economy, to fight against violence, to deal with all of the issues. It's not someplace down in First Avenue. It is, in fact, our only reservoir of hope and advocacy against governments who are far too happy to trot off in the market direction. And we are here in a world in which the United Nations is being really gutted in a way that is appalling. But the gutting of the UN, and I would say led by the United States, is something that we must look at a little more closely. Because if we look at the internal culture of the UN, we have to wonder where women are in the UN. We notice that women are doing what we would say we would do at home. We're in the care economy. Women are running UNICEF. Women are running the World Food Program, the Refugee Program, the WHO, a health program. So women are taking care in the UN. And we are the boys. The boys are doing business under the Global Compact. The Global Compact, I would have you know, is an old discussion amongst NGOs in the UN. We were considered, I myself have been called, a hysterical woman. How dare I suggest that the Secretary General is black, as if he wasn't. And how dare I suggest that he should have at least an empathy with oppression, and that I, as a black person, have every right to expect this of him. This is not polite conversation, but we are not on the polite circumstances. The situation, in fact, is critical for many parts of the world. We have an enormous decline in the capacity of most countries to survive. Women are at the bottom of this. We are in a world in which out of 33 million people with AIDS, 24 million of them are in Africa. A world in which the life expectancy of sub-Saharan Africans will be 30 years in the next 10 years, down from 70. So we are not talking about a world in which you could go out and buy Nike or even buy gasoline. We are talking about a world that is really repositioning itself for the rich. 350 men are worth more than 2.5 billion people. This is not a world in which we have to consider what the role of the UN must be. The role of the UN must be unequivocally and clearly and uncompromisingly to stand in the face of corporate brutality, globalization, profits, in the face of all of that, on the side of the poor and the powerless. This is what the UN must do. When Kofi Annan, behaving like the chief executive officer of the United Nations, ignores the complete distancing of the developing world governments with the Global Compact, we must hold him accountable. This is not the United Nations. We must hold him accountable as the Secretary General. We must hold him accountable and the United Nations to the fact that UNIFEM, the only part of the UN that is mandated to deal with women directly, has the lowest budget, $30 million. That is UNIFEM's budget, $30 million, to service the world women. What we asked for in these discussions about the Global Compact was for, in fact, if Mr. Annan, for reasons that have to do with political realities, feels that he has to hop into bed with corporations, then do the obvious. Where is the Transnational Corporation Watch? Why are we not reinstituting the TNC part of the UN? If you want to have a compact, then you must have the carrot and you must have the stick. Where is the stick, Mr. Annan? Where is it? The stick is clearly on his back because it is not on the corporation's back. So we must ask, why is it we are not having the TNC watch? Why is it we are not running to sign, as many of us as NGOs have tried to have, a compact with citizens? And I want us this afternoon to pledge to something even more critical. And we want a compact with the poor and the powerless. A compact with women. A compact with life. Put it on the U.S. agenda, that this way in which the United States can come into my country, whether directly or indirectly as the United Nations, and say to me, behave, good governance, democratic culture, what is this? You must be transparent, accountable, and none of this obtains in their own yard. We cannot have a world in which there are different rules for the poor and the powerless, and different rules for the rich and the powerful. And that is the world of the Global Compact. They do not have to comply. They do not have to do anything, frankly, just be. They just have to be. The rest of us are asked to open everything. We must open our markets. We must open our governments. We must open ourselves as women to change. We must, you know, take care of the sick when we privatize hospitals. We must educate our children when they make education too expensive. We are to fill the gap. Women have a particular role in all of this. And the role we have is really to look in our own homes, in our own places, in our own countries, in our own neighborhoods. And we are the ones that eventually have to decide on what we consume. The power we have over these corporations is to rate them. I tried to get Ms. Magazine to have the Miss Fortune 500. And perhaps we could publicly call on them to list the 500 corporations that are most negative to women. But you, who in fact have the luxury of choice in the United States, must now have the responsibility of rights. You have a right and a need and an urgent need to help redress this awful injustice that is circling the world. Now we have to insert people into that agenda, and we have to insert women into the people. That is the task for the millennium. Thank you very much.
That was Jocelyn Dow, founding member of the Red Thread Women's Collective in Guyana. She's promoting sustainable business practices, such as a furniture company that uses non-timber products. She has served as a former board member of the Caribbean Conservation Association and on the External Gender Consultative Group of the World Bank. The next speaker is Elizabeth May, the Executive Director of the Sierra Club of Canada and one of Canada's leading environmental activists. You will notice in a moment the dramatic difference between the Canadian and U.S. Sierra Club leadership. Elizabeth May was Senior Advisor to the Federal Minister on the Environment in Canada and helped negotiate the Montreal Protocol in 1987. Elizabeth May.
What I was going to talk about was the United Nations and environmental issues. I grew up believing in world peace through world law, and I believed that world government would make the world a better place. So imagine my surprise as an adult to realize that we had achieved world government, and we now had world trade through world law, and we had a system that was enforcing and forcing countries all around the world to live up to a series of rules to increase corporate profits. But that somehow all those other aspects of the rule of law applied globally to protect human rights, to protect labor, to make sure children weren't in slave shops, to make sure there weren't slaves, to make sure that the environment was protected, to protect our life support systems, none of these elements of world government are in place. Just this one really strong, effective world trade through world law. And as I observed at the end of the Rio Earth Summit, why Rio had failed, and Gro Brundtland, then Prime Minister of Norway, now head of the World Health Organization, was asked what was the single largest reason for the failure of Rio to achieve its objectives, and she said it was national sovereignty. It was the commitment of many countries to say, you won't come into my borders and decide whether I'm burning too much coal, and you won't come into my borders and decide if I'm cutting down too many tropical rainforests. It was the concept of national sovereignty. And since Rio, through the end of the Uruguay round and the creation of the WTO and the adoption of NAFTA and all the things that have happened, we've seen world national sovereignty retreat. We've seen that while countries weren't prepared and governments weren't prepared to allow environmental protection to tread on national sovereignty, the goals of transnational corporations can take over national sovereignty all the time. So we've seen a steady decrease in the powers of the nation state as national treaties to allow trade to reach everywhere and to allow corporate profits to be unimpeded by domestic regulations to protect a workforce or protect the environment or what have you. Those rights of the nation state are surrendered. The rights of the corporations are enshrined in national and international treaties, and yet there are no international treaties that ensure that the corporations behave themselves in this free market, free-for-all that they've got created for them globally. In fact, what we've seen, and most recently with NAFTA, with Chapter 11 of NAFTA, which is a mini-investor rights provision just like the MAI, is that not only can a national government not do things, a state government can't protect the environment of its state citizens from a toxic waste site on its water systems, as San Luis Potosi did in saying no to Metalclad, the U.S. company that wanted to put a toxic waste site in that state. They looked at it, and before the toxic waste site was even built, they said no. Well, Metalclad sued. Many of you know this. They sued under Chapter 11 of NAFTA, and the state of San Luis Potosi now owes the U.S. corporation Metalclad $17 million for saying no to their toxic waste site. So something very strange is going on here, as the rights of nation states to protect their people are retreating and shrinking, and there's no countervailing created force anywhere to say when they've gone too far. And in fact, they have obviously gone too far, or we wouldn't have been in the streets of Seattle. So corporate power grows, and no global entity is there to control the corporations. So do we need world government? You bet we do. And where do we need it most? It's in the area that I live with all the time in environmental work. What scares the hell out of me is that we're not talking about issues that we can afford to debate and procrastinate about much longer. We're talking about trends in our global environment that may well be irreversible. And the one I'm going to just share a little bit about with you on about climate change and the time I've got, and then shift to how we can, in practical terms, reform the United Nations to meet these challenges, is the threat of climate change. We are destabilizing our global atmospheric chemistry in ways that are unprecedented. There's no question on the science on this. I need you to know, up until a month ago, I would have told you that the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, the atmospheric concentrations of this warming gas, that in natural levels is what makes it possible to have life on Earth. I mean, we are so lucky. We are living at the end of a 3.8 billion year experiment to get conditions for life on this Earth just right. And now we're reversing them all. So we've got the conditions just right. We have just the right amount of carbon dioxide 100 years ago, but it's now 30% higher than at any time. And as I said, I would have said a month ago, any time in the last 160,000 years, because that's the last science we had from carbon dating little tiny pockets of air in Antarctic ice. But the most recent article in the Journal of Science that came out about 2 weeks ago has done different carbon through different shells, and they found that the atmospheric levels of carbon that we've now unleashed is higher than anything in the last 20 million years. So we are playing Russian roulette with our life support system. And it's not a future threat. It's happening now. All of you have seen the news reports that they got to the North Pole and there's a lake there. Okay, hello? When do people start saying crisis? We've got a 1 kilometer-wide lake at the North Pole. The Inuit people from the Canada's Arctic have been telling us for years about the changes. The rate of warming at the poles is 3 times faster than the rate of warming anywhere else. The ice is thinning. Experienced Inuit hunters have been falling through the ice and drowning. Polar bears can't hunt for seals because the ice cover is disappearing. That's why they're starving. Peary caribou are disappearing. And the permafrost is melting. Now, this is really a scary phenomenon because it's what the scientists call a positive feedback loop. With climate change, forests go up in smoke. The smoke releases more greenhouse gases. That's a positive feedback loop. Permafrost releases methane as it melts. Okay? Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So we're releasing more greenhouse gases because we've been releasing greenhouse gases, because we burn fossil fuels, because we don't know how to get to the store without an SUV. Okay? So what's happening in Canada's Arctic is astonishing. And for the Inuit villagers, if my friend Rosemary Kaptana was here, who grew up in a town called Sachs Harbour on a place called Banks Island, she could tell you that the first thing about permafrost melting has meant that people in her village don't have any place to put the food for cold storage. Permafrost melting is interesting to look at. I've seen the videos taken in her village. It's like a mud slide and water racing off of it, and the ground is concave. And they're starting to think they may have to move the village. We have a very serious problem. We need mechanisms to deal with it. I thought in 1990, when the Rio process started with all the original preparatory committee meetings, that the United Nations was going to help us solve the problem of climate change. Global treaties to protect our life support system are essential. And we thought when we got to Rio, we might get one with binding targets. Well, as you've already heard, Bush, that being Daddy Bush, wouldn't sign anything that actually had a binding target. So we went to aiming towards reductions. And then we got to Kyoto with binding targets that are weak in and of themselves and won't get us to anything. The only thing if we implement Kyoto, what it does is it delays the doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere by 10 years. And we're arguing about it. But what Kyoto doesn't have, as a direct result of the existence of the World Trade Organization, Kyoto doesn't have enforcement mechanisms. Now, the Montreal Protocol, which I helped negotiate when I was in the minister's office in 1987, to protect the ozone layer, the Montreal Protocol has enforcement mechanisms. We know how to enforce global treaties. The Montreal Protocol enforcement mechanism is that if any country that's a signatory to the protocol starts manufacturing ozone-depleting chemicals like CFCs and selling them outside the terms of the protocol, you hit them with trade sanctions. That's the enforcement mechanism. Well, by the time we got to Kyoto in 97, the World Trade Organization Committee on Trade and the Environment was already saying, are there any environmental agreements out there that are GATT illegal? Now, there's something insane about what's going on here. We talk about these institutions as though they're different things. All of them are made up of the same member governments from the countries where all of us on the planet live. But the member governments have different strengths. And when they're serious about getting a goal accomplished, they create something that looks like the WTO. And when they're not particularly serious, they create something that looks like the Kyoto Protocol or the Global Convention on Climate Change or the United Nations Environment Agencies. If we were serious, we know how to do it. We could be insisting every country in the world shall implement an energy tax, and every country in the world shall ensure that everybody respects that and ensures that their carbon dioxide emissions go down. But we don't take these agreements seriously, and the fact we don't can be seen in the structure and the financing and the way that the institutions have been created. We, in fact, have within the United Nations many, many agencies doing good work for the environment. The main headquarters is the United Nations Environment Program, set up after Stockholm. It's in Nairobi. It does good science. It's warned the world. The fisheries of the world are monitored, and the forests of the world are monitored by the Food and Agriculture Organization. We've got the World Meteorological Organization, which sponsored the conference in Toronto in 1988. That said about climate change, humanity is conducting an unintended, uncontrolled, globally pervasive experiment whose ultimate consequences are second only to global nuclear war. Some of these institutions say some good things. And then we've got the World Health Organization with some environment program and the United Nations Development Program and UNICEF, which tells the truth and says that when they point to 15 million children under 5 who die every year because they lack clean drinking water, that the major culprit is structural adjustment. They don't hedge their words. They say what's true. But what are these institutions able to do? Well, the United Nations Environment Program and various other United Nations auspices have created more than a dozen really good agreements to protect the biosphere, to deal with transboundary hazardous wastes, which one person's hazardous waste is another person's commodity. But still, we've got a convention to deal with it. We've got conventions to protect the ozone layer, to protect the world's life, biodiversity, all the different species. But all of these conventions are scattered. They're all in different secretariats in different cities. They're not brought together in any coherent way. Most of them lack enforcement. God knows all of them lack adequate funding. So when you look at the United Nations Environment Program, note that it's a program. Contributions to a program are voluntary. So the UNEP begging bowl is always out. UNEP doesn't even have the same level of financial insecurity as the UN institution as a whole with the $1.6 billion the U.S. hasn't paid up. UNEP relies on voluntary donations. So here's some modest proposals for what we could do to fix this. Let's look at the WTO and see what we can learn from it. If we were serious, what would a global agency to protect the environment look like? Well, Let's take all the treaties and conventions that all the same governments who created the WTO have signed and ratified. Let's bring them together in the General Agreement on Survival and Sustainability. And the General Agreement on Survival and Sustainability will have enforcement mechanisms. And if you've signed on to something and don't deliver, we don't care who you are, even if you're a big country like the United States, 4% of the world, producing 25% of the world's greenhouse gases. I'm sorry, I don't feel like I'm beating up on you, but I really had to mention it. Well, we will hold you to account at the World Global Environmental Agency. There will be funding, and we will find it through something like the Tobin tax. We'll take that global casino where $1 trillion changes hands every single day in currency speculation and gambling, and we'll take the revenue from that to redress some of the world's ills. I'll just close quickly by remembering that it was some, 40 or more years ago, that a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations created on the floor of the United Nations a metaphor. Was Adlai Stevenson, who, having seen the photos of planet Earth from outer space, was the first person on the floor of the United Nations to describe it as spaceship Earth. Now, it's got its difficulties as a metaphor. It's anthropocentric, and it's got the humans on top and in control and all that. But let's just ride with it for a moment and look at where that spaceship is today. 80% of the passengers on the spaceship are locked below decks. Some are in shackles, and not a lot are being fed. People in first class are having their problems, too. Even in first class, the air quality is getting bad. People are feeling sick. There's not quite enough food. But the gambling's going very well. The people at the table have big piles of chips in front of them. And like the Exxon Valdez, the captain is drunk. But in the meantime, you can't get the players to stop gambling because they keep saying, but we're winning, we're winning. So this is where we need the global citizen society, social movement, grassroots. And what we need to do is say, we're here. We're here to help. We're the psychiatrist and you're nuts. And it's over now and we're taking the controls of your spaceship. Thank you.
That was Elizabeth May, Executive Director of the Sierra Club of Canada. She has written 4 books, including most recently Frederick Street, Life and Death at Canada's Love Canal. As senior advisor to the Federal Minister on the Environment in Canada, she helped negotiate the Montreal Protocol. This is the 5th program in an 8-part series on the complicity of the leadership of the United Nations with globalization and corporations. It was recorded in September of 2000 in New York at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization. An audio tape that includes today's program with Jocelyn Dow and Elizabeth May is $12. The transcript of this full 4-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. And let us know if you want the transcript or the tape. That's 1-877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.